The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, I'm John Ross, and welcome to the Short Circuit Podcast, a weekly roundup of decisions of note from the nation's federal circuit courts. Why are the decisions noteworthy? Well, federal appeals courts hear tens of thousands of cases each year, the vast majority of which never go on to the Supreme Court. So many key constitutional questions that have a real impact on our lives are decided at the circuit court level. Here to discuss the implications of those rulings with me are Clark Neely and Evan Burnick of the Institute for Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement. Evan, first off, can you tell me a little bit about the Center for Judicial Engagement?
Sure. Judicial engagement essentially means assuring that the government doesn't restrict people's freedom without a legitimate justification based on actual evidence. Courts do that in only a limited set of cases right now, and the Center for Judicial Engagement is determined to educate and persuade people and persuade judges about the need for judicial engagement, real judicial review in every constitutional case as opposed to just a handful.
Okay, Clark, can you get us started off?
Well, the first case we're talking about today comes to us from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the question basically is whether federal administrative agencies have open-ended power to solve problems no matter how despicable. In other words, are there limits even to an agency's ability to go after a truly despicable person or organization if they haven't been given the express statutory authority to do it? So basically, we have a collision between the rule of law on the one hand and the limited powers of federal agencies and some really despicable practices on the other. In this case, a very strange practice known as horse soaring. And I actually had to go to Wikipedia to figure out what this is. Horse soaring is where you apply chemicals or blunt objects to the foot of a horse in an effort to essentially make the horse step differently, to lift up its legs when it walks. This is a desirable trait in certain kinds of show horses, and basically, this practice is kind of an off-the-books practice. It's a very cruel way of making horses lift up their legs when they walk. And the question was whether the Department of Agriculture had the ability to require private entities that sponsor horse shows to suspend anybody that they catch doing this practice, even though the federal statute involved did not expressly grant the department that power.
So the government wants to stop people from torturing horses, and the court said no.
In essence, yes, but the court said no for a very important reason, and that is because Congress did not explicitly give the agency the authority to impose particular fines or suspensions, which was the issue in this case. In other words, specific disciplinary mechanisms. The agency had the power to mandate an inspection scheme only, in other words, to determine whether the horses were being subjected to soaring, but the agency did not have the power to impose a particular enforcement regime, namely mandatory suspensions for anybody caught doing it. This is a very important principle because even though the conduct at issue here is despicable and we want the government to have the authority to go after it, or many people may want the government to have the authority to go after it, this agency wasn't specifically granted that power in the statute, and the court upheld a very important principle of administrative law, which is agencies do not get to fill in blanks in their enforcement power by essentially saying anything Congress didn't specifically forbid us from doing, we are allowed to do. On the contrary, if an agency is going to exert power, if it's going to impose its will on private parties, as the Department of Agriculture tried to do in this case, it may only do so when it has been given express statutory authority. Congress can certainly go back and amend this law to give the department the authority it was trying to exert, but the fact that that authority was not specifically given means it cannot be exercised. Unfortunately, that may not be a great result for the horses in this case, but it's a wonderful result for the rule of law and for judicial engagement, which is real judging in all cases with no exceptions, even the ones that tug at our hearts.
Right. I mean, the striking thing about this case is that the idea is abroad that the Supreme Court has essentially abdicated its responsibility to ensure that administrative agencies actually apply and are faithful to the statutes that they're charged with interpreting. And that's simply not true. There's a discussion of Chevron deference in this opinion. Chevron deference essentially applies when statutes are ambiguous. But the Supreme Court has clarified over the course of the last couple of years especially that Chevron deference only not every statute is actually ambiguous. And if the statute plainly says X and the agency does Y or says the fact that you haven't specifically said that I can't do Y means that I can do it, the Supreme Court has cracked down, and the court in this case did the same.
Okay, Evan, let's get started on the second case, which comes out of the Sixth Circuit.
Yeah, okay, so this case it's a remarkable case, and it essentially addresses the question of whether someone charged with murder has a constitutional right to impeach witnesses against him by demonstrating that their testimony is totally unreliable. Fred Blackston was charged and convicted of murder largely on the basis of testimony from two people, Santello and Simpson. The conviction was later reversed. After the trial, Santello and Simpson recanted their testimony, saying that they perjured themselves because of prosecutorial pressure. Blackston is tried again. Santello and Simpson are not available to testify, but the judge read out their testimony from the first trial, the testimony that they later said was false. Blackston moves for a new trial, arguing that the recantation should have been admitted into evidence. The judge says, no, that would have been unfairly prejudicial to the prosecution. It would have suggested that they had inappropriately applied pressure to the witnesses. And Blackston says, look, under the Sixth Amendment, I have the ability to confront witnesses against me. I should have been able to get those recantations into evidence. And the court, rightly to my mind, said, yes, that's what the Sixth Amendment requires.
So just so our listeners are clear, the prosecution in this case makes an astonishing argument on appeal, or at least I find it astonishing. As I understand it, the prosecution's argument is essentially this. The jury in the retrial should not be permitted to hear from these witnesses that they had offered testimony in one case that they then recanted and said was false in a later case. And the reason why the jury shouldn't be able to hear that testimony is it might somehow impugn the integrity or the reputation of the prosecutors?
Right. The court responded essentially, too bad. Concern about your reputation doesn't trump someone's constitutional right to explore the pressure that the prosecutor's office puts on testifying witnesses. If the witness has a motive for favoring the prosecution, that's impeachment material. The court should not have excluded it wholesale.
So there was other evidence against this fellow. What did the court say about that?
Yeah, the prosecution argued that, look, this really didn't matter. These witnesses weren't that important. There was plenty of other evidence against him. And the court scrutinized the record carefully and found that argument to be totally implausible. Simpson was the only witness who actually testified that he saw the murder, and his testimony was referred to dozens of times. Santello directly undermined Blackston's alibi. The remaining witnesses, one was an admitted accomplice who, as such, had an interest in shifting the blame, and the other two were drunk. And as the court put it, drunk witnesses are generally not reliable ones. This kind of careful engagement with the record is precisely what we need to ensure that everyone, even people who are accused of murder, get a fair trial.
Okay, jumping into the third case, which also comes out of the Sixth Circuit. Clark.
Well, it seems like about every week we get a case where the basic question is, can police do anything they want to you when they pull you over while you're driving? Now, of course, the answer to that question is no. Unfortunately, courts only seem to get it right about half the time. Fortunately, this is one of the cases where they did get it right and found that the woman who sued these police officers for excessive force and false arrest, that she was entitled to go forward with that lawsuit. The facts of the case are kind of entertaining. They're a little bit complicated, but basically what happened was wife leaves husband alone with the teenage kids to babysit them. He gets drunk, and he makes a prank call to 911. He then neglects to hang up the phone and starts rambling while the 911 operator is listening, and one of the things he says is that he might kill that bad word about his wife. Doesn't sound like he's very serious, but the 911 operator is concerned, and so she alerts the police, who then proceed to the house.
They're actually after a guy at this point, right?
That's right. The only person they have any reason to believe has done anything wrong or might need to be investigated is the man on the phone. But they also have information that the wife may be on her way back to the house in a car driven by a friend, and so they're on the lookout for that car as well. When they get to the location, they see the car, in the vicinity, and they decide they're going to go ahead and stop the car on the chance that the man who was on the phone might be in the car. So they put on their lights, they do the traffic stop. The woman, who, to be clear, is a friend of the wife, who has just dropped the wife off at the house, has nothing to do with this other than that, is driving the car. And the police make this traffic stop in an extraordinarily violent way. One of the police officers goes up to the car, jerks open the passenger side, the driver's side rear door, and sticks an AR-15 and holds it to the back of her head. A couple of other police officers go to the front, and she's completely compliant. She is not resisting.
And there's nobody else in the car.
There's nobody else in the car, just a woman not resisting. So you got one police officer with an AR-15 to the back of her head. Two other police officers go to the driver's side door. They yank her out of the car. They throw her down onto the pavement 10 feet away from the car. They drop their knees into her spine, handcuff her, then yank her up and start questioning her. The only possible basis they have for detaining her at this point is if she's the man who's made the 911 call, and she's not. But they keep her in cuffs for a full 10 minutes while they continue to question her.
So she sues them. That seems like a pretty straightforward case.
Well, you would think so, but police officers are entitled to something called qualified immunity. This is a defense that was made up out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court, and what it says is that unlike other professionals, unlike doctors and lawyers, you can't sue a police officer unless you meet a very high standard. And that standard is you must show that the police officer's conduct violated a clearly established constitutional right. In this case, the woman made two arguments. Her first was that the length of her detention was unreasonable, and they also used an unreasonable or excessive amount of force. And so for both of those points, she had to show that the Constitution clearly prohibited what they did to her. As I said at the beginning, the court got this one right. The court rejected the police officer's defense of qualified immunity and found that under clearly established case law, holding somebody in handcuffs for 10 minutes after you've determined that they're not the person you're looking for and you have no other basis to suspect them of wrongdoing is, in fact, an illegitimate arrest. It violates their clearly established constitutional right to be free from unreasonable seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and the police officers are potentially liable for that, meaning she gets to go to a jury on that question as to whether or not they have to pay her for violating her right to be free from unreasonable seizure. And the same thing with the excessive force. The court looked at the case law, looked at the conduct of these officers, found that it was absolutely unnecessarily violent. There was no reason why they needed to effect the stop and the detention in a way that was so violent, and she's entitled to get to the jury on that as well. As I said before, the encouraging thing about this case is they got it right. The discouraging thing about these kinds of cases is that courts only seem to get it right about 50% of the time, if that. The takeaway, when police officers make traffic stops, they have to be reasonable in their use of force, and they don't have the authority to simply detain you for however long they want. There are constitutional limits. They must respect your rights, even when they're out there making a traffic stop for people they don't know. Once they've determined you haven't done anything wrong, you get to get back in your car and leave.
Okay, thanks for tuning in to Short Circuit. Be sure to tune in next week and every week for more action from the nation's federal circuit courts. Also, if you have any questions, please feel free to email us at shortcircuit@ij.org.